Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
In our beds again. Just can't wait to get in our beds again. The life we love is in the desert with our friends, and we can't wait to get in our beds again. In our beds again. Going places that we've never been. Going places we may never go again. And we can't wait to get in our vans again. Rubber tramps again. Like a band of gypsies, we go down to Portside. We'll see Bob again. We'll share our tales at campfires in the nighttime. Warm fire time. Marks the end of our stay here in Quartzsite Town. But next year we'll be coming back again.
It's another Midweek Drive movie review special, and we've got a quartet of talent. What the hey? I'll throw myself as well at the present time. We've got Richard Fitzwilliams. How are you, Richard?
Well, I'm certainly very well. It's been a very busy week for me because this was the week of the opening of the Royal Society of Portrait Painters. I've promoted it for some 20 years at the Mall Galleries. We got a 7-page feature in Country Life. We've had two pieces in the Times, two pieces in the Telegraph, and a huge amount of online publicity regarding two portraits of NHS heroes. A very strong show, and it was wonderful. So lucky we were able to open.
Yeah, and again, I appreciate the invitation you sent to my good self, but myself going down to London at present, it's not going to happen. I've just got to point that out. But thank you anyway. The thought was very much there. And Robin Pearce is with us from Wales, of course, the new political landscape, of course, of Wales, given the change of results, which, Robin, you opted for a very sensible, neutral process on, which is fine.
I am a floating voter. In fact, I levitate.
There you are. Almost as exciting as seeing the first Conservative MP for Hartlepool. Yes, home of the monkey hangers as well, established this week. Outrageous, but still, so it goes. It's not political. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Sebastian Mann talking about life in the universe. How are you, Sebastian?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Now, I appreciate that. I was equally a little bit surprised that Richard didn't actually focus on an even more exciting event than the National Portrait Gallery this week. Of course, the official release of Meghan Markle's first children's book. But maybe she'll hold back for a little longer.
Alex, I have to contradict you, because if you look at the Mail online, you'll see my comments. So, in fact, I have.
I did think that was going to come across, but, you know, it was just we couldn't resist it at that particular basis. So another classic, I would have thought.
See, the book itself apparently is published in early June, but there are those who believe that when it comes to relations within the family, and particularly relations between fathers and sons, well, of course, there is a problem. She's estranged, as we know, from her father, Thomas, and also who Harry's never met, and also, of course, as we know, Harry revealed on Oprah that I fear he and Prince Charles, and of course William, are still not on the same paths, to use a quote that he used. This is something, it's interesting you mention it, because I am waiting to see how this develops. It just simply isn't clear to me with all the leaks that have been occurring, the fact after Oprah Gayle King said that any links between Charles and William and Harry hadn't, I quote, been productive. And then Harry, as you know, came over for Prince Philip's funeral. And that was reported on, even if it didn't get that much traction, by Omer Scobie in Bazaar.com. He's a sort of unofficial spokesperson for the Sussexes. And he told us that nothing of note. It basically had been family focused and the ice had been broken, but nothing had been resolved. What I want to know is precisely what.
Richard, I'm sure I speak for a vast majority of people tuning in to Siren Radio, say, frankly, we don't care. Let's move on. So let's actually talk to three movies this week, and they're fairly closely connected for different reasons for myself. A 7, a 7, and an 8 are the scores that I'm actually going for these particular sequences. Let's start off with one which, again, I feel had too much defecation and too much urination in it, and indeed had lots of lovely landscapes, though, and a nice soundtrack. It's behind me now with a wonderful landscape there. Of course, it's Nomadland. Academy Award winner, we know it's done the business from that point of view. Sebastian, your thoughts on Nomadland before Richard launches into the whole sequence of this tale of an all-white America where you actually have an ethical issue about an Academy Award-winning actress who's basically dealing with people who have generally lost their homes and actually, you know, they're sorting out all sorts of other bits and pieces. It seems surreal to me.
I think surreal is a good way of describing it. I mean, it's not the worst Best Picture winner I've ever seen. It's not the best either. I think overall I was sort of lukewarm on it. I liked the feeling of it. It's quite a serene film, which I enjoyed, and I love Frances McDormand. So I wasn't especially bored when I was watching it, but it's one of those films that kind of as soon as it finished, I just stopped thinking about it.
Answer me, oh my love, just what sin have I been guilty of? Tell me how I came to lose your love. Please answer me, sweetheart. You were mine yesterday. I believe that love was here to stay. Won't you tell me where I've gone astray? Please answer me, my love. If you're happier without me, I'll try not to care. But if you still think about me, please listen to my prayer. You must know I've been true. Won't you say that we can start anew? In my sorrow now I turn to you. Please answer me, my love.
If you're happier without me, I'll try not to care.
But if you still think about me, please listen to my prayer. You must know I've been true. Won't you say that we can start anew? In my sorrow now I turn to you. Please answer me, my love. Answer me, my love.
delighted I could watch it on Disney Plus's channels. From that point of view, we'll definitely not be going to see it in the cinema on the big screen. But that's by the by. Robin, have you caught Nomadland as yet?
No. It may well have done the business, as you say, but I have no interest in watching other people do theirs.
Nice. Richard, over to yourself.
Well, I'm going to take a slightly different angle on Nomadland from these rather, certainly in the case of you and Robin, extraordinary comments on it. I mean, just to remind listeners, it's based on a book, Surviving America in the 21st Century, and written, edited, produced, directed by Chloe Zhao, who, of course, won the Oscar, as it did for Best Picture, and Frances McDormand for Best Actress. In 2011, Fern, whom she plays, loses her job as the gypsum plant in Nevada closes. Her husband, who's dead, also worked for it. And she takes a van and travels around the Midwest. It is the ultimate road movie. She takes seasonal jobs at the Amazon Fulfillment Center. She goes to a desert rendezvous to find a community which supports those who the film rather elegantly promotes as the pioneers of the current century, the nomads, those who basically have thrown members of society who have been thrown at the roadside by capitalism, that which is the central message of the movie. But there's also the aspect of individualism, the pioneers that they're considered, and also the fact that basically, it's a movie that it would not normally have greatly appealed to me. But I've seen it a second time after, some time ago since I saw it the first, and it grows on you, the imagery, the way Fern negotiates both the wide open spaces, but also how when she meets, for example, Dave, who's also a nomad, but he's tempted to live a more conventional life and do the two of them come together at all. How, for example, when she runs out of money, does she manage to negotiate her relationships with her family, her sister, for example, who loves her dearly, but of course doesn't link with a lifestyle that is so peripatetic. I mean, it's a curious movie because it grew on me. And as I say, it's not the sort of one not the sort of film, certainly it won't fill cinemas, and it is not the sort of film that I would normally be particularly keen on. Frances McDormand, I mean, she gives a superb performance. You've got this independence, you've got this resilience. It's always part of American pioneering life, tough individualism. And David Strathairn puts, as always, remember Good Night and Good Luck. I mean, a superb actor, puts in a good performance. Also visually, I mean, some extraordinary landscapes, of course. Alex, you did pay tribute to that. And the occasional rather bizarre looking, for example, a Brontosaurus advertising.
Yeah, that was so much better done, though, in Inside Out. I mean, as a sort of image. I mean, Inside Out actually captured it so much more evocatively. But of course, Inside Out is an animated movie, Richard, so you won't have seen that Pixar classic.
Well, I wouldn't have thought that it was necessarily comparable to this. I mean, you're following someone on a journey. And one of the things I did like about this movie, which none of you mentioned, and that was the script. For example, en route, she meets, for example, there's a character called Swanky. It's interesting that some of the characters here, much as we saw with Sound of Metal, where obviously Riz Ahmed is not deaf, but a lot of those players who had parts in the film were. And here there are genuine nomads among the cast. There's, for example, Swanky talks about her life kayaking.
But then, doesn't it become a drama documentary then, as opposed to actual fictional film?
Well, no, I don't think so, because Chloe Zhao has written and produced, edited, and directed. So, no, I don't think so. I think it adds an authentic touch to the aspects of the movie. For example, I talked very very beautiful piece of script where Swanky, whom she meets, talks about kayaking and talks about moose in the river, talks about pelicans flying above her, talks about swallows and the reflection in the water and so on. And there are scenes in this movie, Frances McDormand reciting a Shakespeare sonnet and so forth. I think it's a far more substantial...
You see, that, Richard, is simply an adult's pretender. Simply wanted to get a trinket and saying, I'll throw in some Shakespeare and job done. And it was. She got the Academy Award.
Well, and I mean, that's a very cynical at it. I actually think that she's a favourite of the Academy. We know numerous nominations, a third Oscar. Well, she gets a fourth, she'll be equal to Katharine Hepburn, of course. So, well...
Yeah, there you actually. I'm afraid that's the case. There is no equality between Katharine Hepburn and Frances McDormand. Frances is a good, brave lass, but she's not in Hepburn's league.
Well, I mean, they're totally different, of course. And I mean, the Meryl Streep too. Again, of the three of them, my favorite would be my favorite.
So, but what's your score, Richard? What's your score?
I mean, to be honest, where as I say yet again. Hardly, not my ideal choice of movie, but I would, to be perfectly honest, it grew on me and I would go between 9 and 10.
Wow. I mean, you know, when you're talking about movie classics, I think the sort of epic wonderment of what we see behind me now with Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman is just one of those classic
cases. Oh, my God, Lord. I mean, I didn't... Alex, you're using these quite brilliantly because you've given... May I just tell the team that this is a terrifying memory to me because Australia, which was directed by Baz Luhrmann and set in the 1940s, where Nicole Kidman has a weird walk and an even more extraordinary singing voice. I mean, the way she croaks Over the Rainbow is one of the most fiendish attacks on the ear and oral apocalypse. Really, this movie, which includes the Japanese attack in the Second World War.
Exactly, everything.
Everything to avoid. I urge members of the team who haven't seen Australia, do not go anywhere near it. See William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet if you want to see an excellent Baz Luhrmann movie, but this is a load of pillocks.
I take it then, Richard, you're still maintaining that unlike Nomadland, which grows on you through repeated viewing, that can't be applied to Australia. Maybe it should be not seen.
But Alex, I must protest because you're having a lot of fun with these backgrounds. Last week it was Quo Vadis, and this week you're just having a little. You're being mischievous. Perfectly well that Nomadland had nothing to do with Australia, just as the United States versus Billie Holiday, which
but the character of Frances McDormand, she goes on walkabout in the same way as actually that occurs regularly with respect to native Australians. I just put that out there. Moving on, as you can see, Amanda Seyfried is up online at present, Richard, and she's in Robin's movie this week. Would you like to take this away, Robin? In a whole new area, which again also gets a 7 from me.
Well, I'm a long, long time horror movie fan. I mean, for almost 50 years, I've been watching horror movies. But I'm very hit and miss with haunted house movies. I feel they have more threadbare tropes than even slasher movies. And I'm particularly irritated with films like Conjuring, which depend entirely on a jump scare, a slam close-up and a loud blast of music. You can do that once, but when your entire film depends on that, I'm out because I'm just getting more and more irritated every time that they blast me with music. So I went on Netflix to originally watch Love and Monsters, which was going to be my film this week, but I noticed the card came up for Things Heard and Seen, and
It's got Karen Allen.
Who is
in Raiders of the Lost Ark and Starman.
Yep. And also Perfect Storm. I fell down this rabbit hole of watching this film, and I'm really, really glad I did. One of my biggest problems with horror films, well, horror films in general and haunted house movies in particular, is I never see anything that I haven't seen before. It's all variations on a theme, unless you're talking about something exceptional like His House, which we covered a couple of weeks ago. And what are the odds, really, of seeing something new within that genre or subgenre, you know, within a fortnight? As it turns out, they're exceptionally good. Things Heard and Seen is set in 1980. It's an American horror thriller film written and directed by Shari Springer Berman and Robert Pulcini, based on the novel All Things Cease to Appear by Elizabeth Brundage. It stars Amanda Seyfried as Catherine Clare. James Norton is her husband, George Clare. Now, the year is 1980, and we start off with George coming home one day, finding that something sinister has happened. Blood is dripping down the ceiling onto the bonnet of his car in the garage. And then we go to flashback. This flashback doesn't come to an end until well into the final act of the film. So we know something bad has gone on. Now, Catherine is an art restorer working in Manhattan. They are living very much a yuppie kind of existence. Her husband, George, gets a job as teaching art history.
And the way he actually gets that job is open to a lot of question.
I'm not going near those. I'm not going near those spoilers. This is structured. And the family moves into a large farmhouse in a place called Chosen, New York. Now, anybody who's seen a haunted house movie knows you never move from the city to a remote farmhouse. It never ends well. And I thought, here we go. Same old. Well, there is a presence in the house, and it makes itself known to their four-year-old daughter. And the way it makes itself known is, as she's trying to get to sleep one night, a rocking chair starts to rock by itself. And I hadn't ever really thought about it, but I found this really, really quite disturbing. A rocking chair.
Yeah, moving Val Dunigan moment, Robin. Val Dunigan moment,
It wasn't the spirit of Val Dunigan. It was something else entirely. But we go on from there. There is a supernatural presence. Now, Catherine already feels a little bit isolated. She's had to leave her career, all her friends, and she's by herself in this farmhouse, which she's busy doing up and caring for their daughter. George is, of course, very happy with his position in the college, even manages to start an affair with one of their students.
Yeah, again, you know, this is not good. This is again, a scurrilous misrepresentation of academic higher educational lifestyles put out for the edification of the masses.
Well, you know, it may well do for those arty types. It would certainly not hold water in film studies. And, well, things start to unravel. But the film is not purely about the supernatural plane. The bulk of the film is in the real physical world that we inhabit every day. It's a beautifully timed, well-executed film that takes the time it needs to tell its story. It doesn't depend on jump scares. There's a mounting sense of menace, but there's a twisted misdirection as to exactly where the menace is coming from. Things are not what they seem. These people's lives begin to unravel slowly at first, and it gathers momentum as the film comes on. Now, I found the film very hard to look away from. It grabbed my full attention, which is rare for a horror movie when you've been watching them for, you know, close to five decades.
You've become anaesthetized, Robin. Anaesthetized.
I may well have become anaesthetized, but this showed me something new. It reversed certain roles within the plot line. It showed me some tropes and then mix them up a little bit into a fascinating kind of stew that I had never tasted before. And I walked away from this one at the end very, very happy and satisfied. And this is a film I would definitely watch again. And I can heartily recommend, even to Richard, who I know doesn't like horror movies, but it's not that much of a horror film. It kind of dips his toe into the haunted house trope, but that's not the whole deal here. I have no reservation whatsoever in giving this one a 9.
Yeah, no, 7 for me. I'm afraid that the reality of getting your professor to actually do a seance within a few months of actually meeting them, not going to happen. Sebastian, from your own point of view, did you manage to catch this one?
No, unfortunately not. However, I did see His House a little while ago when we spoke about that, and I really liked it. And yeah, if Robin is also given this high recommendation, it sounds like similarly a worthwhile haunted house film. So I think I probably will check it.
It's a well-spent 2 hours.
Perhaps Robin awarding it a 9 will actually sort of offset Amanda Seyfried's obvious disappointment in not picking up an Academy Award for her work in Mank, which she clearly should have done. But still, that's by the by. anyway, Richard, would you be tempted?
Well, it's interesting hearing Robin's review of it, because it's with his fondness for the Marvel type movies and for everything that is linked to space and blockbusters in that particular field, and his enormous knowledge in areas that normally, I mean, I don't touch horror. Another of them. I mean, I've seen a very few horror films, and the few
animations, of course.
And, well, there it is. Well, I see occasional animation, obviously, but the facts are, I mean, I booked for Peter Rabbit 2 in
Sydney. Wow. You're going for the classics, then?
The first movie that will be shown in London when cinemas reopen on the 17th. That's just about a week. But when it comes to this, I mean, haunted houses, what lies beneath and the others and so on, that aspect of this, I mean, they absolutely terrify me. So I'm afraid the doors creak in them. In this case, I'm afraid the door, however skillfully performed it is, the door will remain definitely closed as far as I can. The fewer movies of this type, and if the better, and Robin was saying how well they were done, I totally accept that that's the case, but the better done, the more scary.
And from thence, as I say, I would basically say, yes, as far as I'm concerned, for what it's worth, a 7 for the Nomadland, a 7 for Amanda Seyfried's Heard But Not Seen, or Things Heard and Seen, whatever. But probably going to up to 8.5, because it's got Amanda Stanich in it. It has to be my top movie of this particular selection, which is indeed A Call to Spy, with an awesome cast. And say, we've got a whole range of things there. And I think actually it does more than just kind of rewrite a whole range of things. It tells us the story of the first CIA female spy, the first ways in which we went through that. I think it's only somewhat sort of questionable that lead actress didn't actually saw her leg off to obviously be part of the whole role, but maybe that'll be taking things too far. Over to you, Richard, A Call to Spy.
Yes, I mean, I think we, years ago, I came to the conclusion that we'd seen almost every single thing that we could about the Second World War. I mean, there'll never be a complete end to it because there's so much fascinating material. I missed because it wasn't, I couldn't get the film of Tom Hanks in Greyhound, which I would like to have seen. But this does break a new ground. Yes, it's an interesting poster, absolutely, and directed by Lydia Dean Pilcher. And we look at Churchill's orders as a special operations executive to recruit women, recruit and train women as spies in 1941. The implication of the film, and I do have to say it does lay it on a bit, that they were so absolutely pivotal to the war effort. But just having said that, I think that this is a story that hasn't been told. It's absolutely essential that it should be. especially since there is a spy mistress, an interesting twist here, Vera Atkins, played by Stana Kajic. Well, she's organising it, but she's Jewish.
She's not a British citizen. She's not a British citizen. She doesn't get her nationalisation processes until halfway through the sequence.
But we don't say whether or not she gets them, Alex, when I'm reviewing. We leave that as one of the question marks because it builds up a certain amount of tension. Certainly it's affecting the character. The person in charge is Linus Roach's Buckmaster, who was Morris Buckmaster, who was the famous spy master. And it's a good performance, someone who's influenced both by the needs of the war and by politics. But the two spies, a truly excellent performances here, because we've got Sarah Megan Thomas as Virginia Hall, who parachuted, at least I'm assuming, if you suddenly see her arrive in France, which is a bit of a strange edit, I thought, into occupied France. The point is to help the resistance fighters, and Radhika Apte as Noor Inayat Khan, who was the first, she's an Indian Muslim pacifist. She practices a Sufi religion, but she's determined to help the war effort. There's a plaque to her, I'm glad to say, that's gone up in London recently, where she lived, and she is the wireless operator who helps in circumstances that are extremely dangerous for both of them. I mean, Alex has mentioned that the wooden leg, which Virginia...
It's what happens if you go out as a child with a hunting rifle and you actually have a slip and a fall. It's not good.
Well, I have to say that I was completely unaware. She is a correspondent for the Washington Post, and she's in occupy in the part of France that was ruled, in theory anyway, by Marshal Petain. So it's rather curious. I must say I didn't know that they allowed American correspondents in. That's how she actually is allowed to start linking up with resistance fighters. As we know, the whole idea of some form of a Petainist regime was totally bogus, but the Germans apparently...
Bring on Klaus Barbie. That's what we say. Bring on Klaus Barbie.
We're coming to the Butcher of Lyon, Klaus Barbie, who I think we've all heard of as particularly notorious, because he's especially keen in tracking down Virginia. And what happens to Virginia, and what happens to Noor, and what happens to agents parachuted in when the Germans may or may not have discovered they're coming. It's actually a fascinating story. And also, again, a movie like this, climactically, it gives you a little history, which certainly I didn't know. This was visually, it's rather a dark film. I have to say the script, it does tend I felt that the script could have let the actions speak a bit louder and be a little less wordy from time to time, but that's a very minor quibble. I thought it was a very good film.
Richard, it has Stana Katic. She was the co-star with Nathan Fillion in Castle. She's an awesome actress, and the way she actually refers to Buck actually had me rewinding. I thought she said something completely different, but it was actually just a buck with a B. Still, never mind.
I hadn't heard of her before, I have to say, but I certainly thought she gave...
You should watch more television, Richard.
In which case, perhaps you would tell me which hours of the day or night I should watch them in.
Let's move on. Sebastian, will this be something you've either seen or will you be checking out? A call to spy, not a call to arms, but a call to spy.
I didn't catch it either, no. Potentially, it does sound like an enjoyable watch, but I don't tend to sort of go for this kind of thing. So I might put it on to expand my horizons away from, you know, the usual kind of repertoire of horror films.
Well, again, intriguing insofar as it actually had its world premiere at the Edinburgh International Film Festival back in 2019. It was released in October 2020 in the United States, so it's had a fairly long gestation. Sadly, no sign of Ian Fleming, which would have made it a 10 for me if he'd only sort of popped in from that side of things. Other than that, very effective. Robin Pierce.
Yes, I'm interested in watching this one. Richard, can you tell me where you actually saw it?
Amazon Prime, yes.
Right, that's the afternoon sorted then.
Exactly. Well,
I'm glad there's a sort of crossover. I'm interested, Robin, by the way. I mean, are you interested in the genre of the war film, or why particularly would this one appeal? Because it's fascinating always that we're so opposite, and yet this apparently, you know, you wouldn't see, say, Mank or Nomadland, but you would be fascinated to see this or interested to see this.
Correction, I have actually seen Mank.
Ah.
What would appeal to me in this? I like some war films. When I was living at home with my late parents, of course, my father having served in Burma in the Second World War, war things were very much the thing. I think I'd be interested in this to find out a little bit more about the role of women spies in the Second World War.
I mean, nobody suspects them, Robin. Nobody suspects
Harry
them.
And that's it. But that's the first one.
Am I right, Robin? I did an injustice regarding Mank, but am I right that Mank was the only one of the nominees for Best Picture that you saw? So you prefer the unconventional or slightly offbeat film?
Yes. Yeah, probably. Yes.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
And on that point, in which we actually sort of go quite clearly to a success for a call to spy, despite the fact that, again, if you are looking at ever hosting after, of course, your portraiture work of Heroes of the NHS, I think certainly Heroes of Australia could be a classic line you might well consider. And I'm sure, again, it would actually get even more coverage in Country Life magazine.
Hugh Jackman is a very, very good actor, but to put him into this with Nicole Kidman, who, given the right role, and I think there have been one or two, The Hours, for example, but dear me, it was
Eyes
terrible.
Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut is a very interesting movie, Alex. Actually, bring it up at the very, very end where there isn't an opportunity to discuss it in detail.
But Batman Returns?
I'm sorry?
Batman Returns?
That I didn't see.
Batman and Robin. All wonderful Nicole Kidman classics. Well, that's pretty much a wrap then. So Sebastian, Robin and Richard, huge thanks as ever. Any teaser heads to next week? I mean, should we all start beginning to sign up for Peter Rabbit 2, Richard?
Well, Peter Rabbit 2 won't be until the week after, I'm afraid, but that is actually at 9:30 on the Monday morning, and it's the first opportunity that I'll have had to see a film on the big screen, and I hope that
it's not the same as watching it on your mobile device, Richard. Honestly,
according to Black Swan and the rest of director Darren Aronofsky, he said, "I don't care if you watch it on my movie on your mobile device. You tell that to Quentin Tarantino and see where that gets you."
Yeah, I think probably there might be a slight difference of opinion between Darren Aronofsky and let's say Christopher Nolan. Tarantino, he has no rights to actually say he wants the big screen, because let's face it, he only grew his whole art out of the video schlock worlds of the 1980s and 1990s. So I'll rest my case there. Gentlemen, many thanks. Take care. Keep watching the movies.
Oh,
This can never not be real. Interesting collection of words there with respect to the title, of course, of the fantastic new young adult novel from indeed the ace author Sarah Milano, who's actually with us now to chat about this and more. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. Nice to meet you.
Excellent. Now, This Can Never Not Be Real actually refers to your novel, which is all about young adults and a terror attack on a local festival. So share with us, without obviously spoilers, clearly, what are the kind of key elements that we've got in this ace piece of work?
Thank you. Yeah, it's a minute-by-minute account of a terror attack at a festival in a small town. And it follows five teenagers that have nothing in common, but they'll need to depend on each other in order to make it through the night. And the focus of the book is very much on the survivors and not the terrorists. In fact, the terrorists aren't a focus at all.
Now, one of the key texts that actually went down extremely well a few years ago when we reviewed it in one of our regular Book of the Month programmes was indeed Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine. And that really got the balance between kind of hilarity through to really deep poignancy as well. Is that something which you've obviously addressed in This Can Never Not Be Real?
Absolutely, yes. It's a big part of the book because I think that humour is a human coping mechanism. So I think that even in the darkest times, people do actually revert to humour and use it as a strategy to help get through things. I've listened to survivor stories from quite a few different terror attacks, and there's often a little sort of a little seam of something hopeful, positive, and often humorous that helps them to get through. And that's very much something that I tried to reflect in my writing.
And certainly there'll be people who might well be possible readers of the book, etc., who will still actually have the tragic events of the Manchester bombing seared on their minds, etc. Was that something else which you kind of thought about in terms of when you were producing this particular text?
Well, this book, because books take quite a long time once they've been written to get published, this book was actually written before Manchester. So that was not an influence on this book, but very much an influence is just the world that we live in today, where there is an awful lot of rolling news about attacks that happen, and they just sometimes feel inescapable. And I find often that on the news coverage, the focus is very much on the terrorists and on the number of the dead. And particularly for young people, I think it can be very bleak and hard to process. So it got me thinking, what if the focus is on the survivors instead? We have some survivors who have told their stories, and I think they're so important to hear. And there must be many, many more out there. So that's kind of the inspiration for the book.
It's always difficult, Sarah, to actually talk to people about their writing process, because literally everybody has a different one. Some people actually say you've got to do this way, you've got to do that way. It's whatever that tends to work. But share with us your own writing process for this particular text in question.
Well, the writing process for this particular one was weird. Normally, I would say that a book comes together quite slowly, often over a year or so. I'll have little thoughts, little pieces of string that I'll gradually tie together to make a book. But for this one, I woke up one night at about 2 a.m. and grabbed my laptop, which I keep much too close to my bed. And I just wrote out what was in my head, which is about 3 pages. And usually if I write something in the middle of the night, the next morning I find that it's, why do sharks like biscuits? It's just some kind of absolute random nonsense. But this was a whole book in 3 pages. And I started writing it that morning and just did not stop until I'd finished the book. And it took me roughly a month to finish the whole thing. And I often got the feeling when I was writing it that if I left the computer for a while, it would be typing itself. It really felt like it wanted to be written.
And how did you feel in terms of obviously getting a very diverse and inclusive cast together? Was that a deliberate approach? You actually felt that you wanted to ensure that this was something which basically did show the sort of strength and unity that obviously can provide lots of benefits?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it was a deliberate choice, because very little about this book was a choice. It all kind of arrived and was like, hi, we're here, write us. But inclusivity in my stories is very important to me, just in general. I never sit down and think, right, I want to include in a character of this ethnicity or this sexuality or whatever, but I try to reflect the world that I live in, and that world is diverse, and it's just much more interesting because it's diverse. You'd be very bored if you were writing about yourself all the time. You do have to take care when you're writing about characters that don't match your own experiences. But yeah, it would be dull if it was just every character like me.
Indeed. Now, clearly, we have been through, and indeed are still going through, the aftermath and aftershock of a worldwide global pandemic. Is this something that you think that actually, when people who might well be reading your book, etc., have been through the experience of maybe losing grandparents, losing loved ones and so on, is that something else which you think also will be connected by what you've actually described in terms of the work of This Can Never Not Be Real?
Oh, gosh, yes. I've actually been finding it's been more and more relevant to people that are reading it and talking to me about it. I think the key is that the book isn't about terrorism. It's about survival. And it particularly focuses on, as I say, this group of teenagers that come through this experience together. And right now, the whole world is collectively going through a crisis that none of us ever imagined that we'd live through. And we're all just kind of trying to hold each other's hands and make it through to the other side, which is really the story of the book. So I think there's a lot of stuff to relate to in the sense of surviving a shared crisis, often surviving loss and keeping going, and just how dark it can get before the dawn, but knowing that the dawn will come, that I think is very relevant to what we're going through at the moment.
And I mean, as you mentioned, obviously this was written a few years ago for that part of you. Have you got other things that you've got in mind that are currently bubbling under with respect to, obviously, I wonder where we'll go now in terms of the bleakness of the 21st century?
I wouldn't say that I'm desperate to write about bleak things all the time. It's a very hopeful book, I hope. And I have actually just finished writing my next book, which will be out around this time next year, I hope. And it's about coercive control, but it's also about love. And I have to say it was slightly inspired by the pandemic. It is set kind of during that because of the stories that you've heard about people who have been kept together with in very bad relationships during the pandemic. So that's something I was interested in. So I guess I do explore issues, but I try to do them in a positive and hopeful way that gives people some strength.
Certainly intrigued, Sarah, in terms of the town of Amberside. Is that a kind of portfolio town? Is it a case of this is just meant to evince or evoke memories of a particular sort of feeling that we've got, or could it be anywhere?
It's anywhere. I deliberately didn't want to use a real place because I didn't want to write about a fictional terror attack in a real place, but it's a little bit inspired by my own town of Guildford, where I grew up, but it's not like Guildford in a lot of ways. So yeah, it's every town. And I think that's kind of also the part of the message of the story, is that it doesn't matter where you are.
SarahMilano.com, SerahMilano.com, presumably a great website to go to, not only to find out work about This Can Never Not Be Real, but also, of course, your earlier works, Boy Meets Ghoul and Boy Meets Hamster,
yes,
which are still around from that point of view. Is there anywhere else that people could actually go to actually keep abreast of your fine work, Sarah? I mean, are you on the usual social media platforms as well?
I am indeed. I'm on Instagram and Twitter, and they're both Sarah Milano on both platforms, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Sarah, it's been great connecting with your good self today. Remember, the book is This Can Never Not Be Real, which I suppose that if you were being a pedant, Sarah, you'd say you're employing a double negative there. What on earth are you doing, employing a double negative? That's, you know,
it's from the book. It's when you've been through something like this. Often when we see the news, it doesn't really feel real. But once you've been through something like that, it can never not be real to you again.
Yeah, that's very true. No, I appreciate that. So we've got two final questions for you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic, Zoom link with us this morning? Has it been okay for yourself?
It's been fabulous. Thank you.
Well, next critical question is, can we look forward to maybe featuring you again in the not too distant future? Will you come back sometime and chat more Sarah Milano goodness?
Oh, yes, please do have me back. It's been lovely.
Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
BNPL. Yes, another acronym. Buy now, pay later. Be very careful, though. Caveat emptor as well with respect to such things, because 61% of UK adults have indeed been financially affected by the pandemic. And as we think about obviously making those purchases, etc., it's interesting that buy now, pay later schemes are being used by over a fifth of us, with nearly a third of people between the ages of 25 and 34 adopting such schemes. Now, to address this, we're delighted to welcome back, after that far too long a gap, to the Midweek Drive with the awesomely talented money expert extraordinaire, it's Jasmine Birtles. How are you, Jasmine?
I'm very well. I'm feeling marvellous after that introduction. Thank you very much.
Jasmine, you know it's always good to connect with your good self, because we know we're always going to get sage and worthwhile advice and suggestions.
Thank you.
So let's move on to this particular study in terms of BNPL, etc. I mean, clearly we might be thinking now, oh, okay, fine, we're heading towards a roadmap to recovery. But the fact of the matter is, the last year and a half has been pretty tough for an awful lot of people.
It has, absolutely. Because, you know, on the one hand, you've had some people who've been on furlough, or they've been working full time from home. They've done very nicely, thank you very much, because they haven't had to spend anything. So we've got people who've paid off debts, they're saving, they're investing. But at the same time, we have a significant number of people who've gone in entirely the opposite direction. They've had no work. In many cases, they've had no benefits either. And so research from a new lending company called Borrow Free has found that it's got to the point where money worries during lockdown have actually triggered a mental health emergency, with 46% of UK adults who've struggled to pay or budget actually considering, you know, having periods of depression and considering self-harm.
Yeah, and which is obviously not good in any way, shape, or form. So what is the best solution if one feels that you're spiraling into debt, if people are listening to this particular piece and they find that actually we shouldn't have actually made those purchases, etc.? What are the kind of key steps you would recommend?
Well, I think that, you know, as soon as you're feeling really worried and fearful, and a lot of people find it difficult to sleep, you know, when they've got all these problems, I would go immediately to one of the free debt advice charities, and there are a whole lot of them. I'm actually patron of one called Community Money Advice, and they give debt advice and all sorts of budgeting advice, etc., out of churches around the country. But then there's also Step Change, there's Citizens Advice, there's National Debt Line, Pay Plan. There really are a lot. And also, if you're struggling to pay your rent or mortgage, or, you know, whatever, there's a problem with the roof over your head, again, I say go really early, go immediately to Shelter, the charity Shelter, because they say the earlier somebody comes to them with their problem, the more they can help. So, you know, if you think, oh God, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent, I'm going to lose a roof over my head, what are my kids going to do? Go straight there, because all of these organizations are dealing with people all the time. You know, there's nothing that they haven't seen before. You could be $100,000 in debt and they'd be like, yeah, whatever, you know, we've seen that before. So that, I think, is a really big thing, to go and get free help as soon as possible. But if you are in work, and this is, you know, I mentioned Borrow Free. If you're in work, then it's worth getting your employers to go to borrowfree.com, because they offer salary advances up to £300 per month. So you can have up to £300 of the money you have already earned. Essentially, you're borrowing off yourself, really. And you can get that money for 0% interest. And it comes in the form of vouchers. So that's a nice, cheap way of borrowing. I would prefer people didn't borrow, but, you know, life throws you a curveball quite regularly, and you just, sometimes people have to borrow. So if you do have to borrow, try and do it at 0% if you possibly can.
Certainly in the pre-pandemic days, the notion of the possibly unlamented passing of Wonga and other payday loan companies didn't exactly sort of fill one with joy and happiness. So I think it's important, perhaps, Jasmine, we talk a little bit about how you do need to be very wary about payday loans. And of course, the magical thing that you actually said about Borrow Free is that it is a 0% interest aspect.
Yes.
And that's critical.
It is critical, absolutely, because the problem has been for so long that it's a crazy thing. If you've got lots of money, if you're secure, if you've got a good job, etc., you can borrow money anywhere, and you can borrow it for really, really little at the moment. money is really cheap at the moment. So if your credit rating is good, you've got a regular salary, etc., you can have money thrown at you. But if you really need that money, if you are on either a low salary or no salary, and you've missed a few payments, so your credit rating is not great, then it's really expensive to borrow. And this has been particularly a problem, as you say, with payday loans, where you end up, you know, you're borrowing £200, you end up paying back £400 or even £600, you know, over time, because the interest rate is so insane. And actually, even credit card borrowing, you know, we think, oh, we're all used to credit cards, but actually, if you don't pay that back within the interest-free period, then you're charged an average of sort of 19-20%. And when you think that the Bank of England base rate at the moment is 0.5%, it's quite extraordinary to have to pay 19 or 20% a year on the money that you're borrowing. And it's the same with as you say, buy now pay later schemes. If you do it right, as with credit cards, you know, if you're on top of things and you absolutely know what you're doing and you pay it off within, you know, the first three payments that they say, then fine, you know, you don't end up paying any interest. But if it does make it far too easy to borrow, and what happens is young people particularly will take, you know, like, oh, I'll have those clothes and I'll have that technology and I'll have, and they're ending up, you know, they forget that they've got all these borrowings out there. They've borrowed all this money essentially, and then the bills start coming in and they get overwhelmed, and they end up, you know, not being able to pay it and having to pay interest later on.
So many ways, it's almost as though Aesop's fables have come to the 21st century to actually, yes, talk us through sort of aspects relating to that.
True.
In terms of, say, borrow free, where would you point people to actually find out the details if people are actually looking to get this initial fix on their finances?
Yes, they're actually launching today, excitingly. So if you go to borrowfree.com, and that's B-O-R-O, borrowfree.com, then, you know, if you're an employee or an employer, you can see how they work. And they don't charge. This is a great, and I speak as an employer here, I'm thinking, oh, they don't charge. Apart from setup fees, it's 0% for the employer, 0% for the employee. They make their money through commissions from the companies that they offer the gift cards for. So, you know, which is kind of win-win for everybody, really. The companies get these gift cards, and employers and employees don't get to pay any interest.
And obviously not to be confused with either Middlesbrough or Peterborough Football Club, so obviously are called Borough in all sorts of ways. I thought initially, is that a football piece we're doing here? No, it's completely different.
It certainly is. Different spelling.
And finally, in terms of obviously those debt help charities for people who are sort of thinking, well, we have got issues with respect to that. Community Money Advice, Citizens Advice Bureau, and Step Change and Christians Against Poverty, probably.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're all really, really good, and they're all free. And as I say, they are so used to people who have all kinds of problems. So doesn't matter how you lost the money, doesn't matter how much you're in debt and how many terrible letters you've had, they have seen it all before. Go and see them and get that help, because they will get you out of your hole.
It's been far too long since we featured your good self, Jasmine, so we've got two final questions for you that's slightly adapted to obviously the technology we're now using. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I have had more than a reasonably interesting Zoomer with you today. Thank you very much.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future and keep us appraised of matters financial? Will you kindly return?
I kindly will. And if you would kindly invite me, I would certainly come along on your esteemed programme anytime you like.